HarperCollins and Harper Audio present Hunting the Falcon, Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn, and the Marriage That Shook Europe by John Guy and Julia Fox. Read by Stephanie Racine. Prologue. Shortly after dawn, on Friday the 19th of May, 1536, Sir William Kingston, Constable of the Tower of London, left his quarters near the eastern perimeter of the fortress and set out around the west side of the White Tower. Passing through the Cold Harbour Gate, the great tower and gateway built by Henry III in around 1240 to guard the entrance to the royal apartments, he gained admission to the innermost ward. Arriving at the Queen's lodgings, he mounted the stairs at the south end of the building and then passed through the recently rebuilt Presence Chamber. After he reached the door of the more intimate privy chamber, he gently knocked. A lady in waiting opened it, and beyond was a slim, 35 or 36-year-old woman of average height with dark, flashing eyes and a long, slender neck. Queen Anne Boleyn, second wife of King Henry VIII. This was not the first time that Kingston had visited her at this hour. She had sent for him early in the morning on Thursday, after keeping an anxious vigil since 2 a.m., kneeling in prayer with John Skip, her trusted almoner. Under sentence of death, she had summoned Kingston while she received the Holy Sacrament of the Mass and protested her innocence of the heinous crimes of which she was accused: incest, quadruple adultery, and plotting to kill her husband. Swearing twice on the sacrament that she spoke God's truth, she declared that she was a good woman and had never been unfaithful. Her belief was that she would die shortly after 8 a.m., the customary hour for such executions. Steeling herself to walk to the scaffold, she had spent many long hours of waiting that night, reconciling herself to what was to come. She so readied herself because one of the four former ladies-in-waiting whom her husband had redesignated as her custodians and whom she detested, possibly her aunt, Lady Elizabeth Boleyn, had informed her that she would die that day. It was a cruel misunderstanding. The date and time of execution had not yet been fixed. When nothing happened, she became sorely distressed. Sending for the constable again, she said, "Master Kingston, I hear say I shall not die afore noon, and I am very sorry therefore, for I thought then to be dead and past my pain." Unbeknown to her, Henry would not approve her death warrant until later that same Thursday. When the writ was finally sealed, it instructed Kingston that, "Immediately on receipt of these presents, you bring the said Anne upon the green within our Tower of London, and cut off the head of the said Anne, and in this omit nothing." There were other reasons for a delay. During daylight hours, the gates of the tower were left open to permit visitors to access the outer ward. Not wishing to arouse suspicions, but keen to restrict independent reports of the manner of Anne's death from travelling abroad, Thomas Cromwell, the king's principal secretary and chief enforcer, had ordered Kingston to expel some 30 foreigners from the tower precincts before the execution could begin. Cromwell appointed his staunch ally, the merchant banker Richard Gresham, soon to be Lord Mayor of London, although he was one of the most hated men in the city, to take charge of security and make sure only those whom the king wished to see his wife die should be allowed to enter, because of the wondering of the people. Equally, Henry, who was planning everything from afar in the minutest detail, intended everyone who mattered to be there. Given the initial uncertainty as to the date and time, Kingston worried that, "If we have not an hour certain, as it may be known in London, I think here will be but few, and I think a reasonable number were best." On that score, he need not have feared. A man not without some human sympathy, Kingston tried to divert Anne's attention from the muddle over the timetable.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?